order to solve the problem. And we begin to do that. And the second step says we come to believe. We come to believe. I didn't believe when I first got here. I didn't think I would get sober. I really didn't. I had great doubt. I knew it worked for other people, but they weren't as bad as I was. See, they didn't have my particular problems. These were people who weren't deep thinkers the way I was. The guy who took me to my first meeting was a mailman. He was not a deep thinker like me. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. So best friend is sitting in front of me here. Ms. O'Keefe begged me to stop drinking. Begged me. For her sake and the sake of her seven children. I mean, there are nine people in this house, and I'm the only one with a shot at income. And I'm sitting in this chair. She got seven kids. She got a degree in English literature. She's not highly employable, you know. She said, "You got to get up and go to work. You know, we have to have some money here." It wasn't that I wouldn't. I couldn't. I might have wanted to be a good husband. I might have. I might have intended to be a nice guy. I couldn't do it. I might have intended to be a father to those kids and supply whatever they needed. And I certainly had the capacity to do it. I was very skillful at what I did, like muscles. It wasn't that I couldn't or wouldn't. I didn't have the ability to do it. I was powerless. I was just sitting there. Oh, I think to myself, I'll be a good father one day. I'll buy a Christmas tree or something. Well, when the time came for crunch, I bought nothing. And then one day this mailman took me to this AA meeting. Al. His name is Al. And the meeting was over. And Al said, "Now, tomorrow night, I'll pick you up at 8 o'clock. And I said, "I'll be fine, Al." And I haven't had a drink since. Now, I couldn't do it for love. And I couldn't do it for money. I did it for the post office. What is that? I mean, what the hell is that? Do those guys delivering mail have something going on that we don't know about? You know? But you see, Al was full of power, and I was powerless. And he had a crappy old car. I had a nice car. I said, "We'll take my car." "Never mind your car." I said, "Just get my car and shut up." We communicated well. I said, "How about this, Al?" He said, "Shut up," he would explain. Amazing. It's an amazing thing. And I spent a lot of time with Al and my sponsor and with another guy who drove a beer truck. And here I am. And I came to believe. See, I was a natural cynic. I mentioned this last time. I'm from New York City. We're cynical there. Huh? I don't believe anything. I wasn't... I just didn't believe things, you know. I remember when the astronauts made that first thing on the moon, that beautiful picture of the Earth hanging in the space, you know, that beautiful globe. I thought to myself, it is round. It's round. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just didn't care, you know. Someone would say, "Well, the Russians," I would give a shit about the Russians. "May I have another drink, please?" You know. So he said, "My mother died." "Your mother died? How old was your mother?" 70, like, "She should die. Give me another." This is the way I live my life. I'm very cynical. I didn't believe much. But, you know, when you start dealing with AA people, funny thing happens, you know. They bring this power along with them. And they say this meeting's going to start at 8:30. It starts at 8:30. By God, or Hillary starts raising hell with them. And they say it's going to end at 9:30. It better end at 9:30. When they say they're going to be there at 7, boom, you can set your watch by them. And they were telling me what I was going to do next and how I was thinking. And they said, and he'd say, stop worrying about that stupid job of yours. You're going to lose it anyhow. How do you know? He says, everybody loses their job. He says, you'll get a better job. I said, Harry, what the hell do you know? You deliver the mail, for Christ's sake, you know? He'd say to me, how do you feel? I said, well, my stomach. He said, no, not your stomach, you jerk. He said, how's your head? How's your head? I said, you're a high school dropout. You want to know about my head, you son of a bitch? So if I explained it to you, you wouldn't understand, you moron. He said, he feels good. Get in the car. And pretty soon I began to sort of believe things, you know. A little by little, not much. And then I'll tell you what happened to me. And this is a very startling event. It was a Wednesday. And it's 30 years ago. It's more than 30 years. It's 31 years ago. Almost 32 years ago. I lived in a town, a village called Larchmont, New York. A very beautiful place. It's on the Long Island Sound. It's where hotshots like me live. And I had the home there. Hillary's been in the house. And Ms. O'Keefe is of the opinion that every child should have his own bedroom. So we had a 9-bedroom house. I am 70 years of age. I've never had my own bedroom. Except for last night in the monastery. It's beginning to look better every day. I should have come here 30 years ago. And I used to have to take a train to work. I worked in Manhattan in New York City, and the train was about a 40-minute ride in the morning. And so when I woke up, from the time I got up to the time I got into my office, I had a law office by then, it was about an hour and a half. And I wanted to drink every day. When I came back the second time, I wanted to have a drink every goddamn minute of every day. See, when you come the first time, you get a spiritual free ride, you know? You get that pink cloud when you come the first time. They pour that spiritual power into you. And you feel it. It's tangible. You go, oh boy. And you learn how to sleep, and you learn how to eat, and you learn how to live like a person. The second time, it's murder. And you're hanging in there by your fingernails. Every goddamn day is another goddamn day. And I'm hanging in there. And brother, I want to drink so bad I can taste it. I'm nervous. I am irritable. I am discontented. But I'm afraid to drink. I'm scared to drink. Because I know what happens to me when I drink. I'm a goddamn lunatic. So I don't want to drink, and I won't drink. I won't drink. I'm home every night. I get in bed, and I go, shoo. And I wake up this Wednesday, and I get dressed, and I get on the train. I go to Grand Central. I walk through Grand Central. I get in the elevator. I go up to my room, my office. I go in. I sit down. And I look out the window, and then it hits me. I did not think of a drink that morning. I did not want to drink. Holy shit. I call up my sponsor. I said, I don't want to drink today, so far. He said, congratulations. He hung up the phone. We're very close. He went. Encouraged me to whine to him. And I began to think about things, you know? My finely trained, incredibly honed mind. I don't want to drink. What the hell? Let's see. I live in the same place. I live with the same people. I work in this place. I've been here now 2 years since I lost my job. I have the same car. The difference is I go to a meeting every night of AA. That's the big difference in my life. I go to a meeting every night of AA. There is something in the meeting that takes people like me who want to drink so bad they can taste it, and does something to their head so they don't want to drink at all. What the hell is that? I knew I didn't do it. I knew if they left me alone, I would drink myself to death. If I had my way, I would have just died drinking. I asked my sponsor. He was the guy. I went to him. I said, listen, what's a power greater than my own? It's a little ambiguous, you know? Plus, I have a capital P in there. And I've been around. I know what that means. And I had no quarrel with that. I just wanted to know if that's what we're talking about. Because then I'm prepared, brother. I got a minor in theology. I'm all right. I'm ready. I got the uncaused cause. I got contra gentiles and summa theologica. Thank you. Thomas Aquinas. I'm ready to go talk about God if it's God. So I say to him, what's a power greater than my own? He said, a power greater than your own is a power greater than your own. Just like dealing with Moses, you know what I mean? You remember Moses, he was talking to that burning bush, remember that? Moses was having this conversation. What are you laughing about? The guy was talking to a burning bush. And Moses said to this thing, who are you? And the thing said, I am that I am. And Moses said, thank you for clearing that up. For a horrible moment there, I thought I was talking to a tree that was on fire. See? Now we got that all straightened out. I said, what the hell are you talking about? A power greater than your own is a power greater than your own. He said, that's what it is. And then he said, and he was absolutely right, he said, listen, and this is what I say. People get the second step, they start raving about God, and then about how crazy they are. Who gives a shit? They could have written their stuff an entirely different way. They could have said, we all came to believe in God. Wilson had enough drag, he probably could have got it through. But you see, they didn't all come to believe. It's a book of experience. Over one half of their number didn't believe. They were not believers, including the vice president of the American Atheistic Association, was included in the first 100. They were not believers. They were not religious. He could have said, we all became Episcopalians, God's frozen people. We all became Southern Baptists. We're right at home here. He said, it's what happened to them. First thing they did, they admitted and conceded to their innermost self where the problem was. Here's the problem. Then they came to believe that, see the word in is not in there, that is a proposition. A power greater than their own would have to be, correct? For people who have absolutely no power, any power is a power greater than their own, correct? Could restore them to sanity. Why not? It's a statement of a proposition. Now, all of the lights are off in this place, but the heat is on. Brother was in here before. He said he turned on the heat. So there must be power somewhere generating the heat. I don't know where it comes from. It could well be in a place this big they have their own power system. It may well be there's an atomic energy plant up the road. Knowing Hillary as I do, he's probably got 16 novices running around a mill down there, in a squirrel cage, just generating enough power to keep the AAs from freezing. But truth be known, what difference does it make? Truth be known, what difference does it make where the power comes from? Correct? What the hell do I have to know where the power is that supplies the light for this room? I don't have to know that. What's good you're going to do me to know all about that? That's all I have to know. When I come into this room at 6 o'clock this morning, as I did, and it's dark in here, all I have to know is where the switch is. So I can turn on the switch and get power in the room. In AA, the switch is the meeting. See? The switch is we. The power comes in when we come in to meet in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't come to the coffee place. It doesn't come to the IHOP. It doesn't come to a car. It doesn't come on the phone. It comes in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why we say this is the regular meeting of the da-da-da-da-da-da. Because, boom, turns on the switch. And in some meetings, it's palpable. Is it not? Have you not had that experience? You can, even now,
Am I? I don't know. I'm overly sensitive, but there's power here. Now you come back into this room in this wonderful place. Come back here. Say at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning. And this will just be another room. Be walls and ceiling and floor. Nothing going on. But come back here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. When that meeting comes, if they have that one they had this morning, it's a powerhouse. It's an absolute powerhouse. And that's because we are here. Bill Wilson needed Dr. Bob just as much as Bob needed Bill. And the two of them to each were powerless, but when they met, when they had that meeting, they turned on the switch. And that switch brings us to Alabama in 1997. And that's what this second step is talking about. Coming to believe that we can turn that switch on. You see, I didn't come here for a religious education. I'd already had one. If someone comes to me now and says they want to stop drinking, I don't take them to church. What for? It's not the purpose of church. I have nothing against church. I think church is fine. Millions and zillions of people enjoy church. But that's not the function of church. We have here for the first time, and that's why we celebrate June 10th. I never finished that thought. There have always been people who didn't drink. But on June 10th, 1935, there were two people in this world who didn't drink. Two. And the second one didn't drink because the first one shared his experience with him and turned that switch out. And that's why we celebrate that day, because that was the day the power went on in the life of Bill and the life of Bob. The power that wasn't there before they met. Is it not your experience? I know it's my experience. That most times when I come to an AA meeting, I leave feeling a little better than I came. Correct? Not a whole lot, you know, but at least for some portion of the hour, not the whole hour, I'm not constantly self-absorbed. For a little part of the hour, I may be thinking of something else or someone else. Okay? I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. But for an hour, as the program is there, the hour of power, for an hour here, it isn't so necessary for me to think of myself all the time. I can think of you all. And think of what the speakers say, and my sponsor trained me to listen as though I was going to have to answer whoever was speaking. When they go around the room, the kind of meeting I really like, I'm formulating answers all the time. So then it keeps me involved in the meeting. And that's my experience. I came to believe that there was a power here much greater than my own. And that power has come to me in so many ways. I'm not going to get into it, it's not important. But there are times when I am really a powerful person, as once I was. And it's through no doing, and I know where it comes from. That's the most important thing, I know. And my sponsor used to say to me, and I get full of myself, you know, after all, here I am, I'm back and I'm top of my profile, all that stuff. And he'd say, he used to, when he was annoyed with me, he called me professor. When he liked me, he called me sailor. And he used to say, keep your memory green, sailor. Keep your memory green. We'll take a 5-minute break now and we'll start on the third step. Thank you. Okay. Now this proposition is one that says we'll be restored to sanity, and that was okay with me. I went to my first AA meeting from a locked ward in an insane asylum. I didn't surrender. They captured me. They came and got me, brother. They just showed up one day with a net, and
This is the first time, and threw me in there, and I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side. And in addition to everything else, it was on the occasion of my 35th birthday. I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was standing around, and I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that day I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said they had two other presidents in residence. That was my introduction to AA. So when they say restore the sanity, I mean, it doesn't mean a great deal to me. And I always liked the Jay Walker in the book. I always thought that was just the best thing in the world, was that stupid Jay Walker. Goes across, knocked out his back, breaks his arm, knocked out his ass, breaks his leg. His friends say, Charlie, you got, I know, I'm going to stop, don't worry, I'm not stupid, I know jaywalking's no good, you know what, you think I'm dumb, ha, and the inevitable day, he's in the hospital, he's out of the hospital, he says everybody's bothering him, and the inevitable day, the fire truck gets him and he's all finished. And it says, put in the drinking for the jaywalking, isn't that the same, you bet it is. That booze took a hold of me and it just beat me and beat me and kicked me, and I got up. I got up every time. I was resilient. You won't do that to me, you bastard. Bam. Down I go. It's going to be different this time. Bam. There I go. And not only insane, our book says strangely insane. Not only insane, strangely insane. There was a doctor, a very famous man in alcoholic circles named Jelinek, and at one time alcoholism was known as Jelinek's disease. And Jelinek, a physician, was the head of the Yale University School of Alcoholic Studies, which is now at Rutgers University. And these people, alcoholics, he was not one, baffled him. Baffling. He said, God, not only are they weird, I'm used to weird people, I'm a psychiatrist. But look at the things, you know, when you least expect it, they take that right-hand turn, you know? So he said to his associates, this is all too much for me. He said, what I have to do in a scientific endeavor is make myself an alcoholic. He said, I'm going to become one. And he set out to do it. And he said to get me booze. So they brought him a bottle of bourbon. He drank about half of it. And he fell out of the chair he was sitting in. And he hit his head on the desk on the way down. And when he hit the floor, he crapped in his pants and passed out. They woke him up about 3 hours later, and he said, I will never, ever take and drink anything like that ever again as long as I live. That's not us. That's not us. We're up, down there, banging on the door. You got anything left? You got any of that crap in a bottle? You know that stuff? The stuff that took away my law license, my wedding license, my driving license, my ownership of a house, of a car, my children, my self-respect, my name, my reputation. Is there anything left? I'll have a triple with a twist of lemon. Ah. That's us. And bartender, when the bartender, you know, you say to the bartender, how much does that cost? He should say, throw up your wedding license, your driver's license, your law license, your deed to your house, your passbooks for the bank, your children. Throw it all up on the bar. That's how much it costs. And you know what? We say, fine. If that's what it takes, by God, I'll do it. And we did it, didn't we? I did. I threw everything up there. I spent the last 3 months, I drank, basically living in an automobile. I had to drink. Wasn't I didn't want to, wasn't I wanted to, I couldn't, I wouldn't, I should, I do. That was the way it was. And I knew that there was no way out. Because in the neighborhood where I grew up, if the creature got you, it got you. It was like a defense. I said, what's wrong with him? What the hell did he throw her down the flight of stairs for? I said, well, he's drinking. Oh, well, it's different. That's all right. He's drinking. I thought from his he was mean, spirited or something. Oh, no. He's just drunk. He threw it down. Well, he likes her all right, but he was drunk. She was there, so he threw it down the flight of stairs, you know. Better harder than the dog, you know. Pardon me, madam. I didn't mean to offend you in any way. And, you know, we talk this way. We talk, and nobody's kidding anybody. We all know what a power greater than our own is. Nobody's kidding anybody. We all know what it is. And if you're new, I hope some people here know. I hope they know. There will come a day, very soon, I think, when you recognize this power. It'll come right into your life. You'll recognize. You'll see it for what it is. And you'll know it, and you'll call it by its name, the same as God. It's always been God. It's always been God. Bill said, I read last night when they talk about the book, said one guy said, we'll give them the God business a little later on. We'll take them in. And that's the way they do it. It's one step at a time. You can't read too much into the second step. Because they give it a name in the third step. They call it God. And it's God as you understand it. And now I've been around now, oh, I guess maybe 6 months, something like that, maybe longer. And the second time, it's hard to remember, you know, so long ago. But I do remember he came up to me and said, well, you got to make up your mind now. What are you going to do? I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you got to make up your mind whether you're going to stay here or not. I said, you think I quit? What the hell are you? He said, no, but you may want to leave. You may want to go out. Back where you came from. I said, back where I came from. That's like saying to me, how would you like to go back to Duluth for the weekend? You know, I've been to Duluth. I saw the bridge. I froze my ass off and I ate execrable food. You want me to go back to Duluth? Yeah, sure. Not this year. Some other time. And that's what he's saying. He said, I can stay here. Now, you know, after you're here like 6 months, you should have caught my act when I had 6 months. Boy, I knew a lot. And people were coming in after me. Sit down over there. Be quiet. Be quiet. Stop that whining. Goddamn whining. Don't drink and go to meetings. Don't mind about your goddamn wife. Stupid bastard. I knew where the bathroom was. I knew where to park the car. How to get? Don't get the coffee over there. We use this pot first. Then we use it. For Christ's sake, you know. Really wonderful. And he wants me to leave now. He said I could go. I said, what the? I'm just getting started here, you know. Be my empire next. And, you know, I only came in to stop drinking. I just wanted to stop drinking. That's all. I did not come around here to become a Christ-like figure or a spiritual giant. It just sort of worked out that way. And he's telling me that. I said, well, what are you? And he said, I'm talking about the third step. He says, you got to make a decision. Look what it says there. Make a decision. Now, I've been to meetings. I heard him talking about this third step. And he said, make up your mind. I said, well, how about my will, my life? Don't I give that to God? He said, that's a joke. He said, you're going to give your piece of shit life to God? Are you serious? God will be so thrilled. Get that crappy life that you can't manage? I said, well, it says that up there. He says, it does not say that. Fool. And I said, well, what is the question? I don't know what the question is. How could I know the answer? I don't know the question. He said, here's the question. And here's the question for you. Here it is. How will you live? See? You will in your life. How will you live? I don't make too many pronouncements, but here's one. There is no requirement in this fellowship that you turn over anything to anybody for any purpose. Forget it. The step doesn't say that. It never did. I hear these people, oh brother, the first step they want to, you know, how they drank. I tell you about every last goddamn drink they ever had. It's interminable. You know, like they drank any differently than you did. The next bunch in the second step, I want to tell you how crazy they are. You know, who cares how crazy they are? But when you get to the third step, oh, brother, they are in the hands of God. They're on his lap. You say, you going with us Friday night? I haven't heard yet. If it's God's will, I'll go. If it's not God's will, I will. So what's up with the movies, for Christ's sake? Are you going? They don't know whether they get the premium gas or the regular gas, wear the red tie, the blue tie. God hasn't told them, you know, save me from these people. And the step, the English language doesn't say this. It says make a decision. That's the first thing. Make a decision. Turn over your will and your lives to the care of God. Ask God to have a care for you. That's all. That's a comforting notion. And the central question is, how will you live? See, your will in your life. How will you live? You going back there? The creatures out there. There's lying, cheating, stealing out there. It's cold out there. The nights are very dark out there. The days are very long out there. There's that hole in the center of your being where the wind blows. You remember that? It's 4 o'clock in the morning out there. You want to go back out there? Are you kidding me? Not a chance. Not a chance. How will you live? You want to live this way? We have a way here, do we not? That's not doing drinking or not drinking. We have a way to do things here. This is a way to live. I had a book in my hands this morning. It said, The AA Way of Life by Bill. We do things a way. Don't we have a way? We treat each other a certain way. Huh? And I was just terrible. I mean, just the way I am. Arrogant, no good, person. He and I would show up, you know. I'd see a car that wasn't parked right. And I'd say, look at this. Hey, look, he's on the grass. All right. Whose car is that? You want to get, move that car. And he'd say, what are you doing? You in charge of parking? Well, no, but his car's on the grass. I said, what the hell has this got to do with you? Well, it's on the grass. He said, does that affect how you live? Where you work? Or where you going to sleep tonight? He said, is that your grass? It's on the grass. He said, we don't do that. I said, no? Oh, no, we don't do that. I said, what do? Oh, we don't do that. Well, what should I do? Yeah, why don't you sit over there and mind your own goddamn business? Oh, all right, you know. Okay, he's parked on the grass. But we have a way, right? We have a way. Who the hell does he think he is, you know? We have a way of treating one. We have a way of not generating that kind of stuff. And that's how I will live. We live honestly. We try. We're not, thank God we're not saints, right? The book says we're not saints. Thank God. If we had a saint here, where would we put him? Next to you? Or next to me? Get away from me. Oh, my name is Frank. I'm from Assisi. Get out. Jesus. No, thank you. Another time, Frank. Later, you know. We have a way here, and this is the third step. How are we going to do it? How will you do it? Will you care for one another? Will you come to these meetings? Will you be on time? Will you have a sponsor? Will you have a home group? There are no mountains to climb here. Just get along. Get on that path. Get in the groove where you belong. Do what you're told. Stop being a pain in the ass. That's all. Take these spiritual tools and use them. Be kind to one another. See, this is the oldest message in the world, is it not? There's nothing new here. You know, we stole it off of religion, sociology, psychiatry, medicine. But we have a definite way of doing things, do we not? When I see people doing what I want them to do, I say they're willing. Well, at least he's willing. He's not the smartest guy in the world, but he's willing, you know. Let him make the coffee. So. And then when he's doing what I don't want him to do, he's a willful bastard, isn't he? Jesus, he's willful. You know, I told him to be here Tuesday. He didn't come till Wednesday. He's willful. Boom. He's not doing exactly what I told him. And that's what this is. And it says we ask God to have a care for us. That's a very comforting notion, I think. When I drank at the end there, that was one of my moans, one of my whines. Nobody cares. Nobody gives a shit. I'm going right through it, brother. I'm in that porcelain appliance, and I'm going right out to the sea, and no one's even noticing how I suffer. Oh, if someone would only care, you know. Just awful. And frustrating and bewildering. But here is someone who is ready to care, if you ask for it, to have a care for us. And it says, God, as you understand him. Now, there is no requirement in the world for you to understand God, as you know. I mean, nobody understands God. Maybe Hillary understands God. I don't. Well, if I don't, he doesn't. Thomas knows. There's no requirement you understand God. He said to me, we're going to use that word a lot, God. He said, you have to have a knowledge of what you mean when you say that word. What does it mean to you? He said, it doesn't make any difference what it meant to your mother and your father, or your church, your schools. Because you are the one who has the alcoholism, and you have to understand what you mean when you say God. And as I have told you, I'm not a church goer. I'm not against church, I just don't go. Doesn't interest me. But you can't help but notice around here how much we talk about God, how much we use God, and I knew it was going to be important, and so I started, again, applying my mind to this business. And I knew that every night at the end of the meeting, they said the Lord's Prayer. And the two words of the Lord's Prayer, the first two words are, Our Father. And that was a good idea for me, Our Father, because one of my constant whines when I was young is I never had a father. The other kids had a father. I never had a father. Bastards, you know. And I resented that terribly. That really got me going. Until, you know, beyond the point it should have. But I am a father. I have seven kids. And I know all about being a father. I know seven kids worth. That's a lot of experience as a father. I've had seven high schools, seven colleges, two law schools, you know. And I've had to say yes many, many, many times in the course of being a father. And I've said no many, many, many times in the course of being a father. No. God damn it. No motorcycle. Oh, no. No, no. No junior year in Italy. Are you kidding? Get out of here. Christ. Get a job. No. Get out of my house. That kind of stuff. Now, I would say no to them, but that doesn't mean I didn't care for them. I care for them. Sure I do. I didn't tell them where to live. I didn't tell them what college to go to. They told me. They said, here's the college I got into. I said, that's nice. Here's the money. Go away. Go to college. No? I teach at St. Thomas Law School, Miami, Florida. It's 10 years old. My son Jimmy got accepted at Harvard Law School. At St. Thomas, he goes free. I said, Jimmy, does this mean you're not going to St. Thomas Law School? That doesn't mean I didn't have a care for Jimmy. It just means I'm cheap. But I didn't tell him, you know, what schools to go. They told me what schools they were going to go to. They told me what schools they were able to get into, and they went. And they are very, very, as you might imagine, very successful. Successful children. I have movie stars and all that kind of stuff. More information on later. But I've often said no, and I know about this business of being a father. I just know it because I experienced it. And now, for the first time in 43 years, my wife and I live alone. We don't have any children who live with us. This is the first year that's happened. So we've been, you know, in the father business for 43 fun-filled years. And so I thought that would be a good idea for me. When I think of God, I think of God the Father. It's not a new idea, but I just think of him in a sort of a paternal way. And I ask him to have a care for me. And God knows he does. All of us. What are we doing here? What in God's name are we doing here? Sitting around on a Saturday in November in a monastery, you and I? Huh? Our book says, here are a group of men and women, worldly indeed. This is not the Ladies' Aid Society. You got the great roue here. 5,000 bars. That second one was pretty close, but I think so. Worldly indeed, who are all agreed on one thing. They have had vital spiritual experiences that have changed their lives. And that's true of everybody in this room. And I don't know you. I don't have to. It's true of everybody in this room. There has come into your life a power. And it is no less than the power of God. No less. What other power could do for you? What has been done for you? Nobody could do for you what has been done for you. And ever since man have had these ideas, this idea that there is such a power external to our own, greater than our own, I don't know how long that idea has been around. It's in the earliest of all possible civilizations. Everyone has had their notion of God. We are Western here. We have a Christian notion for the most part. But, you know, there are other civilizations. There are Buddhists, and there are Hindus, and there are Taoists, and there are all kinds of people, and they have all kinds of ideas. And the American Indians had ideas. Every civilization had ideas. And the idea has always been that this power, usually benevolent, cares for you, but you have to communicate with it. And so it is with us. And this power that I'm talking about, we speak to it. And in our book, it's a prayer. And they put it in as a prayer. And they start out by saying in here that the third step discussion starts right after the very famous ABCs. You remember ABC? A, I was alcoholic, could not manage my own life. B, probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. C, God could and would if he was sought. Remember that? The next line in the book is, being convinced we were at step three. Just what do we mean and what do we do? What do we do? There it is. We are set free, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understand him. Just what do we mean by that, and what do we do? Earlier in the book it says, clear-cut directions will be given to you. Well, it couldn't be any clearer cut than this. Well, first of all, what do they mean? And then they tell us about the actor, the director, the guy who screws everything up. He says, the first thing we mean is this, that a life based on self-will cannot be termed a success. And that was my life, based on self-will. You see, I was successful in that sense and very early, based on self-will. I did what I wanted to do. It didn't make any difference what I was told to do, or who advised me to do things, or who didn't. I just put my head down and did them. I just kept going to school, I kept getting jobs, I kept working. And I knew that I was going to get out of there. I was going to get out of that neighborhood. I was going to get out of that bunch. And I was going to move. And I did. And it was based on self-will. And it all crashed. So that I spent my 35th birthday on the lock and key. So self-will only lasts for a period of time. And I was not a success in the business of living. I did not know how to live. I knew how to earn. I knew how to succeed. I didn't know how to live. I learned that here, because I got some principles here, because I'd never had any principles. And he talks about the actor. He says, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, and that's me. And it says, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Hereafter, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. And then it goes on and expresses something that was talked about this morning here at the meeting. They were reading some of the stuff from Emmett Fox, including his wonderful thing on the Lord's Prayer and on the daily bread, which is a favorite of mine. And there is a statement here in the big book. It's a law, a spiritual law of supply. And it says, when we take this position, that is the position of the third step, which is asking God to have a care for us. It says, when we take that position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Having a new employer, he is all powerful, and he will provide us what we need if we stay close to him and do his work well. Now, at one point in my life, I was an employer. I was a senior partner of a 40-man law firm. And if you came to work for me or for us, I made sure a number of things. I made sure, first of all, you were paid well. I made sure you had a room. You had a desk and a chair and a computer and a secretary and a library. Because I wanted you to do my work well. I had that ability. I generated a lot of work. I couldn't name them. I used to have 9-10 people doing my work. And I wanted them to have everything they could get out of me as long as they did my work well. And they stayed close to me. These people were working for me. I wanted personal loyalty to me. And we had a whole section of the firm. My partners used to gripe and moan, but they liked the money. So I understand all of this. I understand all of this. And this is a law of supply, you see. They were reading this morning from Fox. He says, your father knows what you need. I know what my children need. They don't have to tell me they need a suit, a coat, and shoes, a place to live, transportation, education. I know all that. I hope they want something special, they better ask me. But the regular stuff, I know all that. And this is all learning. This is nothing new. Be not solicitous, it says. Be not solicitous. Christ used to talk about the lilies in the field and how they grew, and the birds in the air and all of that. And that law of supply is here. How many times have you heard in your AA career when you pick up the phone and whoever's on the other end says, you know, I won't believe this. And then he tells you, the job came back, the family came back, the kid came back, the wife came back. Stuff, it couldn't happen, it's impossible to happen. Remember that? Well, how many times do you have to hear that before you realize what we talked about last night, that God is constantly doing for us all that we could not do for ourselves. And I'm talking about things. It's a law of supply of things. I'm not talking about spiritual growth. Thing. I like things. I like material things. I got two homes. I got a big cattle. I like things. I was never able to get them. I was too busy. I was drunk all the time. Very hard. God does all that stuff. Plus, the original, the most important stuff is I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where it all begins. And I don't know God's will. How the hell would I know? You know, when you pray, you talk to God. If you have God actually talking to you, it's usually schizophrenia. And I certainly don't know God's will. He doesn't call me up and tell me what's going to happen. But I'll tell you, I know where I've been since 1965. And so do you. You are the world's greatest expert on you. Nobody knows better than you where you come from, what you've done, what you've experienced, and what you are now experiencing. You know that better than anyone possibly could know it. Why not? It's your life, isn't it? And you're not to give this life away. There's no requirement in here in this program you give this life up to anybody. Why would you do that? That's your life. God gave you that life. It's yours. Use it. Enjoy it. Oh, someday you may have to discuss things, what you've been doing, but in the meantime, that's your life. Don't give that up to anybody. Why would you do that? That's such a dumb notion. And you will. It's your will. You need that. You will succeed. You will live. You need your will to carry on. You're going to get all the help in the world, but you will take care of yourself. Getting sober is sometimes very much like dying. You've got to do it by yourself. Or you're going to get all the help in the world, but it's your baby. And there isn't anybody who can do it for you. Nobody can do it for you. And nobody can take it away from you. Or you can give it up if you want. A lot of people do. But it's your will, it's your life, and God doesn't want that. The only thing that this book tells us that God wants from us is maximum service to Him and to our fellows. And we do that in a routine sort of a way, don't we? It's not a big deal. It is not a big deal. There are no mountains. It says God does not make hard terms with those who seek Him. Is this a hard term? Come by this beautiful place on a weekend. Be with people you know, people who know you. People you love, people who love you. What's hard about this? You have to listen to me, but you get over that. See, the book of experience, this is what they found out. They found out that this law of supply was in action. Remember, they came in the Great Depression. Everybody is broke. Nobody's got any money. Bob can't make his mortgage. Bill is living in people's homes, sleeping on couches. He and Lois never had a house to live in until after World War II. They never had a place to call their own. They lived in his father-in-law's place. The bank took it away. They lived in a 24th Street clubhouse. They lived in people's living rooms. They lived in Muncie up in Rockland County, a summer bungalow in the winter, and they froze their ass off. Finally, they got their own place after a long while. But it came. Inevitably, it will come. I don't think God has a wristwatch or a calendar, but things come as they are supposed to come. And that's what's true here. When we take, I'll read it so I don't make a mistake. These are new glasses, so it takes a little while. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. Further on, it says we could face life successfully. We could be a success at the business of living, not in just the business of earning, or the business of promoting or advancing, personal advance. Although, believe me, all of that stuff's important and nobody knows it better than I. Remarkable things happened. In 1962, I was forced to resign from a job as a tenured professor of law. That's a job you have for life. And they asked me to resign, and they had me, and there was nothing I could do about it, and I did resign. And I knew when I resigned that I could never, ever be a law professor again. Because once you resign under the rules of the American Law School Association, that's it. You're finished. Go do something else. And I did. I was a lawyer. I never asked anybody, including God, that I be a teacher again, because I knew that's impossible, and I don't pray impossible prayers. And I was sober about 10 years, and a phone rang, and a judge said to me, I have been asked to go on the board of advisors of a law school, and I'm too busy. Could you go? And I said, sure. So I went on the board of advisors of a law school called Pace Law School in White Plains, New York, big school. I was on their board of advisors about a year, and the dean said to me, how would you like to teach next semester? I said, well, you know, I was at Fordham, and I went through this thing with him. He said, I know all about that, but this is part-time teaching. This is not full-time teaching. So I started to teach. I had kept up with Fordham. I had made all my amends. And they used to trot me out at the alumni dinners because I'm amusing sometimes. And I was the master of ceremonies at this dinner. And I was introducing the governor and all the rest of them. And I sat next to the dean, new dean. And I introduced him, and he got up and made a deanly speech. And then he said at the very end that I'm going to reappoint Professor O'Keefe. Never said a word to me. And there I am, I'm reappointed. And now I'm a teacher at two law schools. I'm one in the fall, one in the spring. So I go to the one in the Pace, I go to Pace one night. And a guy note my box, see Professor so-and-so. I go see Professor so-and-so. He said, they're starting a brand new law school in Florida. The Catholics are starting, the Archdiocese is starting this law school in Florida. How would you like to be the senior tenure professor? I had a house in Florida. I had a license back to law in Florida. So let me think about that. So now I'm in Miami. Now there's three law schools. And I think this is pretty good, you know. All sorts of remarkable things are happening. And they're especially good because they're happening to me. You understand? Self-absorbed to the very end. And I'm there about a year in Florida. I get a phone call from now the new dean at Fordham. That's the next dean. And I don't know him too well. He says, come to my attention that your kid is graduating here in June. How would you like to give the kid the law degree? So next June I'm in Lincoln Center and I give my kid a law degree. What is that? What the hell is that? I tell you, it gets me going. Give me one of your things. It gets me going. Every time I think about it, it gets me going. And I never once asked for it. Never once asked for anything like that. At all, because I was told, thanks, it is true, I wasn't supposed to pray for crap like that. I wasn't. And when you get down to this three-step business, right at the very end of it, you know what it is? You know what it is. It's a prayer. That's what it is. And it's a prayer. And it says here, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person. So what I'm going to suggest to you now, and I want it to be as voluntary as possible under the circumstances, is that we go through this third step together. All right? Now I'm going to read it slow, and I want you to say it after I read it. Now we're going to say it together. So hold hands. And we're going to do this if you want to. Now if you don't want to, here we go. God, I offer myself to thee.
God, I offer myself to thee.
To build with me and do with me.
To build with me and do with me.
As you will.
As you will.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
That I may better do your will.
That I may better do your will.
Take away my difficulties.
Take away my difficulties.
That victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Your power, your love, and your way of life.
Your power, your love, and your way of life.
May I do your will always.
May I do your will always.
Congratulations, you've just done the third step. Thank you very much. That's it. I make the equation between those first three steps and an emergency room in a hospital. You know, an emergency room in a hospital is always on the ground floor because it's there to handle emergencies. It's not there to diagnose disease or to treat people, really. It's to make sure that all the vital signs are right, that the pressure is right, the temperature is right, make sure somebody doesn't die right on the spot. And when they're finished, the emergency's over, then they take you up to the seventh floor, and there they kill you at leisure. They do a test and retest and search and research and all that stuff, and they practice medicine, and they do a diagnosis. What's the matter with you? And a prognosis. What's going to happen to you? And they give you a course of treatment. And these first three steps, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that second time, in my own mind at least, I was in a state of emergency. I needed help now. And if I wasn't going to get it, I was going to turn into a puddle of pee. I was going to blow up and or disappear, or something bad was, I didn't know what was going on. And they handled me as an emergency. They sat me down, they gave me half a cup of coffee so I wouldn't throw it on them, and they told me the things that we tell new people. It's going to be all right. It's all right. Don't, Jesus, slow down now. And you and I have seen it a million times. They come in here like I did, leaping, getting out of the way of parked cars, all that kind of stuff, nervous wrecks. And then they settle down, I settle down, and I told you I know where the bathroom is, and I'm going to put the car, and how to act. And then about, I don't know the time period, maybe 8 months, and very strange things happen to people like me. They begin to talk in a very funny way. They begin to say things like, there's no parking. You can't park here. Now, 6 months ago, this bum did not have a car. But he's worried about parking now. And they say the same thing all the time. You notice that? They're going on and on all the time about the same old stuff. And, then the best one, because it's changed now. The best one in the world used to be, they smoke so many cigarettes. It hurts my eyes. My eyes hurt. This is the same moron that was in some dump saloon at 5 in the morning with the smoke so thick you can't even see the ceiling. And he was lapping it up, saying, don't close, one for the road, all that crap. You see, what's happening here is he's developing some kind of a code, because the emergency is over and he has not received any treatment yet. And his problem is not the booze. He is telling you he is nervous, irritable, and discontent. It's a pain in the ass. It's repetitious. And because he's gotten no medicine, he's gotten no treatment. Because the treatment is steps 4 through 10. And if you don't get off that emergency basis, when you go through 3, you go into the AA waltz, 1, 2, 3, slip. That's what happens. And you've seen it. You've seen it 100 times. And you go to a meeting on the first step, they want to tell you how they drank, say how crazy they are. Third step, how they're wrapped in the arms of God. Fourth step, I'm working on that. 80% of Alcoholics Anonymous is working on the fourth step at all times. And then they have another bunch who says, I've done it. Of course I've done the 12 step, these lying bastards. But I'm not satisfied with it, and I'm doing another one. I'm on my fourth one at the moment. I have a drawer full of them at home, and I have the Hazleton guide. I have something from Nebraska, 3 from Texas. That's just saying I don't want to take the medicine. That's all that is. I don't want to take the medicine. I'd like to get better. I know I have the disease, but I don't want to take the medicine. Medicine is not fun. It's not designed to be fun. Never was fun. We have a different attitude about medicine. You go there and the physician says, here's a bottle of this brown, noxious, terrible tasting crap. Take a teaspoon every 4 hours. So we take 4 teaspoons every 10 minutes. It's the way we are. But come around here, say, write down an inventory of what's the matter with you. I'm working on that. And if you don't take the medicine, it's a very simple proposition. You either take the medicine or you get sick. And in this disease, you get sick and you die. And some people, and I've seen it, so have you, would rather die than write down what's the matter with them. And it's not a big deal. And it's all laid out for you in the book. They knew I was coming. They knew there'd be people like me that would come here, pains in the ass, with an education,
who know every goddamn thing there is to know. And so they put a form in the book of how to do it. Look, they did it. See? Look. This is the big book. See this one? Now, this is, you got a cover which says big book, so it leaves no. This is Marshall. Says big book. See? That's a big book. You read the black part here. Don't go around reading this white part, because you'll go blind. And some of you are going blind from that other thing. So if you read that white thing, and you'll get blind twice. But the black thing has the information. See? And in the black thing here, it says very simply, resentment is the number one offender. Did you ever meet a new alcoholic who wasn't full of hate, rage? You remember? Huh? Takes a little while to cool down, doesn't it? That's what it says. It destroys more alcoholics more than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. We have been spiritually sick, and this is the answer to it. It's a tool to use. And here's all poor old Mr. Brown, all these years, Mr. Brown. This guy, he's paying attention to my wife. A little question of sanity there. Told my wife of my mistress. And he may get my job at the office. Now, by any civilized standard of conduct, by any norm of human behavior, we're dealing with a museum-quality son of a bitch here. But this book says that if I am resentful at him, I drink. He doesn't drink. He doesn't know. I mean, he doesn't even know matter. He drank. I drank. I get sick and I die. It says, write it down. They call it a grudge list. And people come to me, because I'm a kind person, and they say to me, beloved guru, they say, which is how I am addressed in most groups, but not this one. But I need help with my fourth step. And I say to them, moron, I say, because I have love and tolerance. It's not a, with you, it's not a four-step problem. And with a lot of them, it's not a four-step problem at all. You know what it is? Here's what it is. They don't want to make a searching and fearless moral inventory because they've never made a decision to stay here and to ask God to care for them. The reason they have never asked God to stay here and care for them is because they have not yet come to believe that there is a power here that's going to help them. And the reason they have not yet come to believe is they have never conceded to their innermost self that they are powerless. It's a first step problem. If you are as powerless as I am, and are able to concede it as deeply as I concede it to my innermost self, you'll do anything. So you get out from 4 o'clock in the morning, you'll do anything. And it's a first step problem. Now, some of them just don't want to do it, but there's nothing I can do about that. They say things, you know, they go to the older people, you know them, they say things like they need help. I'm supposed to tell them who they hate. What the hell is that? What, are you kidding? You, who do you hate? Everybody. I hate everybody. My brother, my sister, that bastard. I can't tell anybody who they hate. And nobody has to tell them either. They know. They just don't want to write down. That's all. Then you turn over the page and it says, we listed our fears, even though no resentment was attached to them. Same thing. What are you afraid of? Nobody can tell you that. You know what you're afraid of. Who knows better than you? And that fear, my fear was terror. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid I was going to die. I was afraid I was going to live. I was in that position where Bill says, he says, I can't imagine life drinking or not drinking. I couldn't imagine going on another second like this. Whether I could drink, and I knew when I drank, I turned into crap, and when not drinking, I was going to jump out the window. And I knew those fears, and I didn't want to, you know, I'm no rose, let me tell you. You know how long it took me to do this? 3 years and 45 minutes. You got it? 3 years of bullshit. I'm working on it. I'm right on that, I'm on top of it, I'm circling around it. 45 minutes with a pencil. Again, they come to me because they're graduates of some dump farting academy in West Kansas or someplace. And they got a suitcase with them. And they say to me, beloved guru, they say, would you do my fifth step? I said, my God, you just got here doing the fifth step. And they yanked this thing out of the suitcase, and it's their autobiography. Oh, my God. What could be possibly be worse than the autobiography of a self-admitted egomaniac? My God. Now, the step is in the English language. It says make A. See that? It says make A. Do it. Get it over with and get on with your life, will you, for Christ's sake? One. Make A. Fearless and searching moral inventory. It says inventory. The book says a business that doesn't own inventory will surely go broke. That's true, we know that. And if you have a shoe store, some business that needs an inventory, tell me what good it's going to do you to write down on your inventory what you had on the shelf when you opened the store 35 years ago. Things change. Ancient resentments. What good is it going to do you to know you didn't like your mother? Of course you didn't like your mother and father. You're an alcoholic. You get sober, they get a little better, mothers and fathers. You don't like anybody. An inventory is what's on the shelf now. What can you to sell now turn into money? That's what an inventory is. Not what happened 35 years ago. Not when your brother took your Christmas present, broke it, and you've been chewing on it ever since. What the hell is this? You're 2 years old? That's right. That's right. Now what are you afraid of? Tell the truth. I'm not afraid. You are too, you lying bastard. I was afraid of living. I was afraid of dying. I was afraid of illness. I was afraid of being without money, without a job, being alone. I hated being alone. Well, I'd like to be alone. Get away from me. I'm alone now. I hated that. I like to be with people. I'm scared to death all the time. And being alone, how is that, Jesus? You know, you're not going out, are you? You know? His Majesty the Baby. Big, tough criminal lawyer. Not so tough. And that's what it says. Write down your fears. And then you have resentments and fears. Then it says, write down your faults. Where were we at fault? It says, look and see where you're at fault. And basically at fault, and it says in another part of the book, you know, medicine really isn't able to tell us why we're alcoholics. Well, what causes it? Oh, they talk a lot. Every year they talk about some more, and I'm all for it. They talk about neurons and neurotransmitters and endorphins and THQs or some crap like that. It's very nice. And then they get down to the X factor. Well, as an expert in science, I took biology 1. The X factor is you're unknown. That's all they don't know. But we know. We say 2 times what's wrong with. We say defects of character were the immediate cause of our alcoholism and our failure at life. See? Not a question of drinking. It's a failure at life. Unable to live. Unable to understand the basic mechanics of living. And in another part it says, defective relationships were the cause of our alcoholism and of all of our woes. You see, these things don't operate in the air, so to speak. There's no such thing as an abstract resentment or an abstract fear or an abstract fault. These things operate in our relationships with people. That word has come into disrepair over the years. My relations were my cousins. See how the Irish are. Your cousins, and your uncles and aunts, you have a relationship with them. They're relations. They have a relationship with anybody else. However, time marches on. That was then. This is now. Relationships. Alcoholism deprived me of the ability to have one. I was so selfish, that I could not be a friend to my friends. I could not be a husband to my wife. I could not be a father to my children. I could not be a partner to my partner. I could not be a teacher to my students. Wasn't that I didn't want to be? Wasn't that I didn't intend to be? Wasn't that I wouldn't have liked to have been? Sure. I did not have it in me to do those things. Because of this. Because of this. And until I find out what's the matter, it's going to stay the matter. And if it stays the matter, I will never enjoy a relationship with anybody. And I'm talking about all kinds. You know, we have social relationships, business relationships, sexual relationships. That's the next page. You turn it over. It says now about sex. It does not say now about deep, meaningful relationships. It does not say now about love. And it doesn't say now about marriage. It says now about sex. And I've been around. I told you this morning. I've been there. Excuse me. A little wine. And then they give you a sex manual in this book. And it's no different about sex than it is about everything else. It's God. That's what it is. It's the same in sex, it's the same as everything else. It's spiritual in here. It says, you see, there's a lot of myths about sex in AA. A lot of myths propagated by women. Those are women who aren't being bothered much by men. And they say you can't get laid for a year. Sure, you must have another book. I'm looking in this book. Where the hell is it? I've been through this thing for 32 years. Where does it say that year business? I don't see that in it. Here's what it says. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal. God forbid. Oh, heavenly Ned, what next? Someone might have some sex around it. Don't you dare. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we will have learned our lesson. We are not theorizing. These are the facts out of our experience. You understand? These are experience. It says here, in sexual relationships, as in all relationships, the basis of it is to be honest and unselfish.